Well, thank you very much, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you very much for the wonderful invitation, and it is a great honour indeed to speak to such an august gathering as this with so many experts in this room. I'm most of all conscious of the fact that that this is the graveyard shift, and I am, I think, the 14th speaker today. And most of the people in this room have been here since before 9 o'clock this morning, so I'm particularly conscious of an audience which may well be falling asleep even before I start to speak. I think this is part of the German thing, this ability. I'm afraid that I don't any longer, it must be just a part of growing old, I don't any longer have the capacity to sit there for 9 hours worth of being talked at. But anyway, here we go. I've been asked to speak about the term itself, but Volksgemeinschaft, potential and limitations of the concept. And I will be speaking in English, as the more perceptive of you will maybe have already noticed. And so I am going to translate this term, which many people say is non-translatable, but I will call it the people's community, defining people, of course, in a national racist way. And about 35 years ago, when the social history of the Third Reich was still in its infancy, the essential reading was, of course, David Schoenbaum's book, Hitler's Social Revolution, practically the only serious study of German society under Nazism then in existence. And those of us in England at the time, working in the field, were for the most part fairly critical of Schoenbaum's claims that a change in status perception amounting to what he called a triumph of egalitarianism had taken place between 1933 and 1939, and that interpreted social reality reflected a highly united society in which traditional class structure broke down. Generally, what interested us at the time was the gulf between Nazi promises of a social utopia, summarised in the propaganda slogan of the Volksgemeinschaft, and the reality of class divisions. Tim Mason, at the forefront of work on the social structure of the Third Reich, captured the way many of us thought about the failure of Nazism to win over industrial workers in his monumental study Arbeiterklasse und Volksgemeinschaft, published, I think, in 1975. So at that time, our concern was essentially with class society and whether the Nazis, whatever the promises, had been able to transcend it. And the answer seemed fairly clear-cut. The impact of Nazi race policy on society played little part in this work. That really changed only from the 1980s onwards. In the meantime, the old debates about class have something of an antique ring to them. Nobody speaks much of class any longer in connection with the Third Reich. The Holocaust, as we've come to call it, on the other hand, dominates every consideration of Nazism, to the extent that all aspects of the regime's activity and its impact on German citizens are now seen through that prism. This drastic change in perspective has in turn completely affected how we've come to view German society and how the concept of the people's community has come to be used. But staying for a moment in the mid-1970s, a major breakthrough in the empirical study of German society in the Third Reich was just getting underway with the hugely innovative project run from the Institute for Zeitgeschichte in Munich, Bavaria in the Nazi era. The remit to undertake research on resistance in Bavaria was turned into a vehicle to explore multifaceted forms of everyday conflict between society and the regime. But the more political nonconformity was uncovered, the more the project also revealed acceptance, approval, and acclamation of much of what the regime stood for. The project had seen as its task the examination of regime and society in conflict. But as its work was taken forward in countless local and regional studies in the Vogish Alltagsgeschichte, or the history of everyday life, so the perspective shifted irreversibly away from opposition and dissent towards conformity and consent. Regime and society seemed thereby less in conflict and more in unison, as research revealed myriad supportive actions and initiatives from below that eased the path for regime policies or even actively promoted them and made their implementation possible. The old emphasis on the Nazi state's repressive apparatus and the dangers of defying the heavy hand of coercion in a police state was gradually replaced by an emphasis on willing consent and active complicity. And as the Holocaust came into focus at the base, not just at the pinnacle of Nazi society, so it seemed that there was scarcely a strand of daily life that was not somehow inextricably linked to the dire criminality of the regime. Here too, therefore, an enormous interpretive shift had taken place. Where once, through the extension of the concept of resistance, it had seemed that practically all Germans had somehow been opposed to Hitler, now practically all Germans seem to have been complicit in Hitler's crimes. The people's community, integrating Germans in the regime and gaining its very definition through the discrimination against those who did not and could not belong, was increasingly coming to be seen as the conceptual vehicle for the complicit society. Another change in historical thinking, far from confined to the Third Reich, mentioned a few times today, influenced this shift. The earlier emphasis placed upon social structures gave way gradually, under the impact of a cultural turn, to interest in affinities, belief systems, psychological impulses transcending class or objective social position, a trend magnified by the decline in interest in class in the wake of the upheavals in Eastern Europe and the collapse of state communism. Alongside this ran a revitalised acknowledgement of the role of ideas, so that in the context of research on the Third Reich, Nazi ideology started to be taken seriously, whereas it had often been seen as little more than a jumbled amalgam of half-baked notions and propaganda slogans. What could sometimes seem like abstract functions, structures, and processes of Nazi rule lost much of their appeal as research drivers and were replaced by increased attention paid to the ideological motivation of the actors or perpetrators of Nazi genocidal policy. Once more, the recently attained undisputed centrality of the Holocaust playing its big part in determining the research agenda. Willing cooperation and outright complicity seemed in need of a concept to embrace the success of Nazism in winning over much of German society to a genocidal project. The people's community, once seen as no more than a failed propaganda construct, took its place as a real Nazi success story. This is where we've come from. The background is, I think, necessary if we're to try to understand both the ubiquitous presence of the concept of the people's community in current discussion about the Third Reich and the possible advantages and pitfalls of its usage. A difficulty is certainly that the concept often seems inexact where precise analytical meaning is sought for it. In recent writing on the Third Reich, it appears, in fact, to have been used in at least three separate, if related and overlapping ways. First, as changed social and power relations. Secondly, as a term of affective integration, emphasising its mobilising force, the vision of a better society. And thirdly, as denoting inclusion and exclusion as defining characteristics of Nazi society. This with, of course, obvious implications for the implementation of Nazi policies of racial discrimination, persecution, and extermination. Whereas earlier research emphasized the failure to even out class differences to produce greater equality, the newer work stresses the attractiveness, also to younger members of the industrial working class, of inequality in a hierarchical society, and the chances for social mobility, status advancement, enhancement, for example, through the rapid expansion of the armaments industry or through the agencies and affiliations of the Nazi Party. Other ways in which the people's community gained concrete shape with integrative force are seen in the leisure organisation Strength Through Joy, the so-called democratisation of consumption through state-directed production and subsidised prices, greater mobility for women, and aspects of social policies such as family benefits or widened social insurance. Assessing how far workers were actually integrated through organised trips to the theatre or rambles in the countryside is, however, more difficult than describing the propaganda and organisation. While it's very easy to exaggerate the growth of a consumer society in the 1930s, so the limits of the actual social change achieved and the instrumentalisation of what was done to prepare for war have to be, and are, acknowledged. Social policy was seen in this way, at very best, ambivalent. Such arguments fit into the long-standing debates about the modernising effect of National Socialism and how the regime broke the earlier class-bound structures of German society in ways that later came to benefit the Federal Republic. Again, however, it seems easier to claim than to demonstrate the continuities between attitudes supposedly swallowed in the Nazi Volksgemeinschaft and those that were a product of the collective effort to get Germany back on its feet after 1945, then the exploitation of the economic miracle of the 1950s. In the second approach, it is the promise rather than any supposed reality of social and political unity and overcoming class divisions in natural resurgence. It's this promise that's crucial. It would be a misunderstanding, it's been said, to take the term Volksgemeinschaft to mean social reality, as if social differences or property relations had been levelled out. The political force of the Volksgemeinschaft arose, it is argued, from its promise and potential for mobilisation, not as a gauge of social reality. What counted primarily, therefore, was not reality, but perceived reality. People thought things were getting better, that the future was bright, that hard work would bring them rewards, the society based on the just deserts of achievement, not inherited position, was an attractive proposition, while non-achievers, or those perceived to be threats to the achieving society, were seen as outcasts deserving of no pity. Social and political realities were increasingly interpreted through the lens of community rather than the lens of class, it's been suggested. And these feelings, coupled with the promise held out in a booming armaments economy and a country that could hold its head up again in pride, bound people, including industrial workers, to the regime, providing a strong integrative force. As Norbert Frey put it, from the viewpoint of the ordinary Germans during the mid-1930s, the Third Reich could well be perceived as a phase of consolidated rule. For large proportions of society, still the quotation, for large proportions of society, including workers, the ideology of Volksgemeinschaft seemed to be solid and even attractive. Whatever the reality, the Nazis, and echoes here of Schönbaum, were successful, so the argument runs, in creating the feeling of social equality. Crucial overall, according to Frey, was the feeling that life had changed. During this period, a large majority of Germans really believed in a national resurrection. This approach offers, to my mind, greater potential than the first. Nazism had been able to exploit, before coming to power, the profound sense of the social, cultural, and political divisions that racked the Weimar democracy in order to win support through an appeal to national unity. The notion of the organic community as opposed to the amorphous society, as in Ferdinand Tönnies' famous distinction of the 1880s, had long roots in German intellectual circles. For many in the educated bourgeoisie, the creation of a sense of community, of the ethnically delineated people, was necessary to overcome the damaging divide between nationalism and socialism. The bourgeois youth movement inculcated in many young Germans an idealism that emphasised what one tract called an organic, unpolitical love of homeland and people, which was seen as self-consciously different from the patriotism, nationalism and imperialism associated with France and Great Britain. We tried, as a retrospective from the 1950s put it, in terms which sound to British ears like mystical gobbledygook, we tried to sense the meaning of German reality from the inner essence of the German people. He found the term Volksgemeinschaft a very attractive and seductive one in the 1920s. The First World War gave a lasting currency to a sense of national solidarity and unity, boasted by Kaiser Wilhelm II's proclamation in August 1914 that from now on he knew no parties, only Germans. As the Nazis gradually gained a hold over a particular vision of the war, they were able to emphasise the need to recreate the solidarity of the trench community, which was an image of some potency. As Tim Mason put it many years ago, the history of National Socialism can to some extent be seen as the attempt to reproduce the experiences of August 1914 as a permanent state, and to seek utopia through a society held together by psychological bonds. And a finding of some note, when Peter Merkel did his analysis of the motivation of early Nazi party members, he established that the biggest drawing card was the desire for a solidaristic social Volksgemeinschaft. The finding has, of course, no pretensions to representative accuracy, but it's an interesting pointer just the same. More systematic work could be usefully carried out on the precise ways in which Nazi propaganda before 1933 used the notion of the people's community to garner support. But even when the term wasn't explicitly used, the appeal to a sense of national unity to overcome internal division was certainly a powerful weapon in the Nazi armoury. That it involved intolerance and violence was no deterrent. Hitler even made a virtue out of intolerance, declaring in a speech to an audience of about 40,000 in the summer of 1932, "We are intolerant. I have one aim, that is to clear the 30 parties out of Germany." The concept of the people's community as a propaganda slogan provided then a base that could be extended in many directions once the Nazis gained power and had the possibility to act in order to play upon such sentiments with a monopoly of propaganda behind them. If the Nazis could be said to have enjoyed enduring popularity, then, as Peter Fritzsche has suggested, this may have indeed rested largely on the idea of the Volksgemeinschaft. The older literature, with its emphasis on class structures, limited social change, opposition to the regime, top-down approaches, and the political functions and processes of Nazi rule, often made it hard to accept or see the reasons for the popularity of the regime in the 1930s. Difficult to grasp the sheer excitement, euphoria, sense of going places, building a future, and personal commitment of millions who saw the years from 1933 to 1939 as good times. In fact, it seems hard to deny that down to the middle of the war, the utopian vision of Nazism was crucial to the regime's popularity and success. The dynamism and vitality, the enormous unleashed energy, constructive as well as violent, that permeated German society in those years can't be explained simply or even mainly by Nazism's negatives, its attacks on the enemies of the people or lambasting of Bolshevism or Western plutocracy. Important strands, though these were, of Nazism's popular appeal. It surely had to do with what seemed a highly attractive vision of a future people's community, strong, prosperous, dominant, and united against enemies at home and abroad. After the takeover of power, the symbolic image of the people's community was not just repeatedly hammered home in propaganda, but given apparent meaning through collections for winter aid, hot pot Sundays, where rich and poor share the same type of simple meal, or an organisation like the National Socialist People's Welfare. Much of this, of course, remained propaganda, and furthermore, with a ruthlessly coercive hand behind it. But it'd be going too far to claim that the image could not become subjective reality. A positive view of the Nazi state, overwhelmingly positive when compared with the broken democracy that had preceded it, and reinforced by repeated forms of mobilisation and inclusivist symbolism like the Heil Hitler greeting to provide an extensive basis of support for the regime. It was a vision in which doors seemed all at once open, anything was possible, sky was the limit. The ideals of the people's community offered prospects for action, possibilities that could be tried out, chances to undertake the previously unimaginable, whether this was technological improvement or inhumane medical practices. Within a few years, engineers could present blueprints for a wide-gauge railway to carry German tourists to the Crimea in so-called travelling hotels, with money, of course, no object. Doctors could contemplate human, not animal, experimentation to improve the stock of the people's community. And any number of German planners for a racial imperium in Eastern Europe could spin their dreams of domination on the back of allusions to the building of the greater German people's community. The concept of the people's community has been and can be utilised to go some way towards capturing this intangible, immeasurable, but nevertheless real and vital psychological mobilisation that gave Nazism its extraordinary dynamism. Most widespread in the recent deployment of the concept of the people's community is nonetheless the third usage, racial inclusivism and exclusivism. Though during the Weimar years, as a contrast to the divisiveness of the new democracy, every political party except the Communist Party, I think I'm right in saying, exploited the implied solidaristic unity of the people's community, the extreme, feeling of belonging to a nation, to a national entity, as opposed to the political divides that have characterised Weimar. So every party apart from the KPD, I think, exploited this implied solidaristic unity of the people's community, but the extreme emphasis on race and biological distinctions to determine who should belong to it and who should be excluded from it was a Nazi speciality. Jews were, of course, explicitly excluded from any possibility of belonging to the people's community in the Nazi Party programme of 1920. And as the Third Reich progressed, the list was extended of those classed as community aliens, Gemeinschaftsfremde, who were not part of the people's community, which gained its very definition, therefore, from those shut out of it. The focus on inclusion and exclusion emphasises the myriad ways in which the majority German population acquiesced in the persecution of the minority. An approach already evident in the work of Detlef Peukert in the early 1980s. Robert Galateli showed only a little later the readiness to help enforcement of racial legislation through denunciation of Jews or their sympathisers. And Eric Johnson followed this up with a compelling examination at the local level of grassroots participation of the population in helping the authorities to terrorise Jews. More recently, Michael Wild, and it's a great pity that he's not here today for this conference, but more recently Michael Wild has shown the corrosive impact of the escalating cruelty in the German provinces towards Jews, deprived of civil rights and any signs of public sympathy, more or less fair game for the thugs, arguing with that that violence arose from the base of society. Ordinary Germans also obviously benefited materially from the persecution of Jews. This could be through taking advantage of boycotts of Jewish businesses, then the so-called Aryanization program, or acquiring an apartment or furniture of Jews being deported to the East. Bonds of complicity were thereby forged. Psychologically too, the sense of superiority, of belonging to an exclusive people, arose out of the ease of discrimination against those so-called inferiors not able to belong, not just Jews, but, for instance, also foreign workers. The Nazi movement itself, embracing, if all the sub-affiliations of the party are taken into account, tens of millions of Germans, provided what is being called a machine of inclusion in the people's community. for Jews, the feeling of exclusion from an entire community to which they could not, by definition, belong, was part of being pushed to the outer limits of society, turned into pariahs. This, in turn, fed into the progressive persecution by the majority, as those who did belong to the people's community regarded the outcasts as harmful elements, depersonalizing and dehumanizing the so-called enemies of the people, seeing a virtue in cleansing the body of the people of impure elements. Using the concept of the people's community in this way has then an important moral dimension, the spreading of complicity in the crimes of Nazism to wide sections of the German people. Now, maybe in this third way, as a conceptual device to explore the ways in which ordinary Germans gradually committed themselves to a trajectory of escalating persecution, ending in the death camps, that the notion of the people's community has particular value. There's no need to choose between idealistic feelings of belonging to a people's community that excluded Jews as a basic principle, and the type of integration through material benefits, or in effect bribery, at the expense of Jews, and in the war of the plundered peoples of Europe, as emphasised by Götz Ali. The two fit easily together. But Michael Wildt's analysis of what he claims to be the integrative, self-empowering effect in consolidating a people's community of the violence against the Jews, unfortunately stops in 1939. Did suppressed information about the murder of the Jews in the East strengthen a sense of people's community, even negatively defined, as the war progressed, making the non-Jewish population accomplices to the dismemberment of the knowledge about murder, as Peter Fritscher claims, bolstering a feeling of solidarity and the need to hold out in the later stages of the war? Or was mass murder, as Frank Bayor puts it, a point of fracture in the broader consensus of the folk community? Given the nature of the evidence, the question is possibly unanswerable. Whether or not the concept of the people's community has real potential for further development, the problems it raises are nevertheless considerable. A major difficulty is obvious. How do you turn a propaganda slogan into a tool of analytical explanation? Even Peter Fritscher, who makes much use of it, acknowledges that, while not to be dismissed, the concept is, as he puts it, dubious and tentative in many aspects. Approaching the concept not to weigh it against the reality of social change, but as a mobilising promise of a better future, makes the people's community into a set of subjective feelings. The question then, of course, is how to measure this emotion, how to demonstrate its existence, how to show it to be the key motivating factor. There are other problems. The concept of the people's community rests upon the assumption of the widespread popularity of the Nazi regime, on the acceptance that it was a consensual dictatorship, eine Zustimmungsdiktatur, on the premise that this was a society largely united in its backing for the Nazi leadership. Robert Gallatini went so far as to claim that the German people, quote, supported Hitler to the bitter end in 1945, and that the consensus broadly held throughout. So how do we ascertain consensus in a terroristic dictatorship? It's difficult enough in a pluralist liberal democracy. Does it make sense to talk about consensus when those who oppose what is happening are locked up and coerced into silence? Opinion surveys in open societies almost invariably demonstrate that behind a minority of core support from major political parties stand large sections of the population whose views fluctuate and vary from issue to issue. Since Hitler's regime, whatever violence it used, was patently unable simply to erase long-standing mentalities formed over decades of pluralistic politics, it seems certain that beneath the veneer of propaganda, varying attitudes on different aspects of Nazi rule continue to exist and can't easily be subsumed into generalisations about a unified people's community. Now, clearly, there was extensive support for important strands of Nazi policy, most obviously Hitler's successive steps to overthrow the Versailles treaty in one tribe without bloodshed after another in the 1930s. It could also be claimed that there was a pre-existing underlying consensus in wide swathes of the German population beyond the organised left on which Nazism could build. Antipathy to Weimar democracy, visceral hatred of socialism, resentment at Germany's loss of great power status, thirst for restoration of order by whatever means, and readiness to accept discrimination and violence against perceived internal enemies and unloved minorities as the price of economic recovery and national revitalization. But a problem with the people's community concept is that it makes no attempt to disaggregate the areas where Nazism could gain obvious popular support from those in which it self-evidently faced great difficulties in overcoming spheres of extensive dissent, even though this could not be translated into outright opposition. The consequence seems to me often to be an inflationary use of the concept of the people's community, a blanket application to explain developments that need demonstration, not simply assertion of the importance of the Volksgemeinschaft. Even in the so-called good years of the 1930s, disaggregation of consensus provides numerous indicators that don't easily accord with broad generalizations about a people's community. Let me provide an example from Berlin in 1936. Of course, Berlin is not the whole of Germany, and Gestapo reports on the mood of the people are not exactly Gallup polls. However, many similar sorts of comment can be put together from reports of the regime's own agencies and from the well-informed and often surprisingly nuanced reports filtered out of Germany by members of the illegal socialist underground. And when the Berlin Gestapo conducted its own soundings into the mood of the people in all parts of the city in January 1936, it spoke of, quote, a directly negative attitude towards state and movement prevalent amongst a shockingly high percentage of the population. This had arisen from the food shortages and rising cost of living over the previous winter. 2 months later, the Berlin Gestapo recorded a marked bitterness in wide sections of the population. The Heil Hitler greeting had, it was said, as good as vanished, apart from uniformed civil servants and people from the provinces. There was much talk of the need for a military dictatorship to provide a fundamentally new and clean state leadership. The report interpreted the discontent as a symptom of a deep-seated lack of confidence in the state leadership, not stopping at Hitler, and huge anger at the disparity between the poverty of the masses and the ostentatious wealth and blatant corruption of the party bosses. Doesn't sound much like a united people's community and a consensual dictatorship. But in that same month, March 1936, Hitler enjoyed one of his greatest foreign policy triumphs with the remilitarization of the Rhineland. The plebiscite of 29th of March brought the perfect result for a dictatorship. 99% of the population in favour. In fact, in Cologne, they managed to get his 103%. So it was an absurdity. But it can scarcely be doubted that there was genuine massive acclamation for regaining full sovereignty over parts of Germany. Most of those Berliners, angered at their economic plight, supported, probably enthusiastically, Hitler's coup. Now that does sound like a united people's community, but it's on this one single issue, a unifying rather than a divisive issue, the issue of nationalist triumph. Its objective function was certainly to bind the people closer to Hitler's aggressive foreign policy. But in other ways, it papered over the discontents of a divided society. And rather than simply resort to a Nazi propaganda term to generalise about consensus, would it not be better to aim for a more balanced assessment of where the regime appears to have popular support and where this was less forthcoming? Another significant sphere in which, in the mid-1930s, those are the time most singled out for the fluid functioning of the people's community, another area in which there was disunity rather than consensus was in the church struggle. Especially in solid Catholic areas, the clash between approval of Hitler and much that he stood for, on the one hand, and detestation of Nazi attacks on church observances, traditions and institutions was acute. Of course, none of this prevented Catholics from cheering foreign policy successes, later on war victories, or approving the regime's anti-Bolshevik stance and its exclusion of Jews from economy and society. But it's far from obvious that feelings of belonging to a national people's community outweighed in importance in the daily life of Catholic and also fervent Protestant churchgoers, a counter-allegiance to a more restricted and also inclusive community. We all have multiple identities. The people's community presumes that one is completely predominant, but that claim is at least open to doubt. Of course, whatever disunity existed in the Third Reich, whether on social policy or on the church struggle, it posed no barrier to the Nazi regime's inexorable progression into world war and genocide. But compliance isn't the same as consensus. Conformity doesn't necessarily denote approval. A variety of forces can compel passive acceptance. The people's community concept evokes, however, not compliance, but commitment. How far this active commitment as opposed to passive acceptance went, and whether it was even necessary for the regime's lurch into genocidal war, isn't easy to assess. Even in the paradigm use of the idea of the Volksgemeinschaft to highlight the exclusion of Jews, it's not obvious that the concept helps greatly in explaining the cumulative radicalisation, to deploy Hans Mommsen's term of anti-Jewish policy, or even to grasp the complex issue of popular support for what Karl Schloen has called the twisted road to Auschwitz. The internal reports on popular attitudes towards Jews, self-evidently a source to be interpreted with great care, have been brought together in the monumental edition by Dov Kulka and Eberhard Jägler. These and other available evidence point to an intensification of anti-Jewish feeling between 1933 and the mid-war years, hardly surprising given the relentless bombardment of the population with propaganda demonising the Jews. There seems to have been general, probably increasing acceptance of the aim of removing Jews from Germany. But the boycott movement of the early years of the dictatorship was not universally welcomed, especially where it ran against the material interests of the population. And in the terrible pogroms of November 1938, the so-called Reichskristallnacht, there was palpable public anger at the violence perpetrated in organised actions by the party or its affiliations, though anger in the main, it has to be said, caused by the wanton destruction of property rather than feelings of human sympathy for the most part. As far as can be judged, this criticism of the means ran alongside acceptance of the aims of Nazi policy, a society free of Jews. In wartime conditions, in a conflict blamed by propaganda on the Jews, the hostility almost certainly grew further. Reports in 1941-2, at the time of the introduction of the Yellow Star and the deportations, suggested that people favoured a radical solution to the Jewish problem. But it seems obvious that those loudly voicing their opinions belonged to the Nazified sections of the population. There were other voices. Even these reports from the regime's own agencies noted some negative comments about the deportations, which they attributed to church circles. However, most who felt in any way critical about what was being done, doubtless a minority, justifiably kept their views to themselves. We can't, in the nature of things, know how many people approved, especially when disturbing rumours of mass killings in the East spread, how many people disapproved but kept quiet, what people really thought, whether there was a consensus, and if so, how large it was, or to what extent it all adds up to a population fully behind its leadership, united in a people's community. How far the simple binary divide between inclusion and exclusion really helps to understand the complexity of German attitudes towards the war might also be open to debate. The lack of enthusiasm for war manifested during the Sudeten crisis of 1938, then again as the attack on Poland began the following year, turned into genuine war euphoria only for a short time after the victory in France in 1940. By the winter of 1941-2, with losses mounting in the Soviet Union and Germany bogged down now in a world war from which no obvious exit route was visible, All the signs are that the popularity of the Nazi regime, also Hitler's personal popularity, started to drop before plummeting after the catastrophe at Stalingrad the following winter. These trends and the recorded swings in attitudes on the home front can be, and have been, clearly enough explained without having recourse to the broad brush concept of the people's community. Internal reports suggest that there were, in fact, often few signs visible of the much vaunted people's community. One outspoken report from Upper Franconia in January 1941, long before things started going downhill, commented morosely, quote, "There can be no talk of a people's community. Each thinks only of his own advantage." Once German cities began to be obliterated by Allied bombs, the popularity of the regime nosedived. Pictures of Hitler started disappearing from those apartment blocks still standing in the ruins. The Heil Hitler greeting was used less and less. Many people in the big cities found themselves spending ever more time in air raid shelters. But the so-called bunker community was scarcely more united than the people's community. Jews were, of course, excluded. But it wasn't just a matter of Germans versus Jews, us and them. There were strident objections from working people that women, children, and elderly, feeble individuals should take up valuable room in the bunkers. It was certainly a brutalisation of society in extreme war conditions. But did it amount, as has been suggested, to a specific morality of the people's community? Meanwhile, those evacuated from bombed-out cities found little community spirit in the rural areas that were forced grudgingly to accommodate them. As Jill Stevenson's examination of Wittenberg amply shows, their hosts often saw the incomers as lazy and greedy. The evacuees, for their part, viewed their hosts as stupid and stubborn. Many preferred to risk sudden death amid the ruins of their cities rather than die slowly of boredom in the countryside. In the final months of the war, there was much talk of a community of faith, Schicksalsgemeinschaft, from which we've heard every now and again today. Now, undoubtedly, the German population was bound together to suffer the fate that the aggression and inhumanity of their leadership had brought on the country. But otherwise, the term was a pretty vacuous one. Why Germany held out to the end owes little to a feeling of belonging to a people's community. It's true that there are indications of shamed recognition at what Germans have done in the East. For party functionaries, especially those in high places, awareness that they'd burnt their boats prompted ever wilder actions in the last phase of Nazi rule. But for most of the population, there was simply no alternative to carrying on. Within the Wehrmacht, as elsewhere, remnants of idealism unquestionably lingered. But defence of the homeland, family and possessions against the ravages of Bolshevik occupation were far more important than a sense of belonging to a people's community. More important still, as motives among fighting soldiers, were allegiance to immediate comrades and ultimately self-preservation, every man for himself. Not least, this final phase of the war brought terror and repression boomeranging back on the majority German population. What had been exported came home with a vengeance. Terror, far more than solidaristic feelings of a people's community, prevented any prospect of a repeat of 1918. Let me come to a close. How, looking at the concept of the Volksgemeinschaft, the people's community, should we view the balance between potential and limitations? The term was a Nazi propaganda construct, as we all see, and accepting it as such still offers some scope for its use in historical analysis, particularly in exploring the ways before and after 1933, a deep-seated thirst for national unity was exploited to extend the regime's hold over society, organisationally and psychologically. Used as a symbol or a metaphor to evoke the ways in which the regime sought to mobilise the enormous energies, social motivation and idealism of many Germans in a utopian vision of an achievement society, the idea of the people's community, its focus on the idolized charismatic leader Hitler, had an important part to play in the effective integration of wide sections of the German population especially down to 1940 and 41. The ways in which the ideal of the Volksgemeinschaft served as guidelines for action in quite disparate spheres have already prompted some valuable reassessment of German society in the Third Reich and offer perhaps the most fruitful potential for deploying the concept in future research. Not least important was how the ideal gave social legitimation to the escalating radicalization of regime policies towards Jews and to the drive to war. Used as a device to point up the exclusion of outlawed social groups, most of all Jews, the concept has residual value in opening up aspects of everyday life in the Third Reich in which willing participation in isolating and discriminating against those deemed not to belong pushed on the spiral of persecution. On the negative side, however, it has to be accepted that the term is an imprecise instrument. Most of what it seeks to explain at the social level can, for the most part, be explained anyway, and usually in more subtle and differentiated ways. And in turning the spotlight on what is labelled self-empowerment, Selbstermächtigung, a term not altogether clear, but implying mobilising drive from below rather than direction from above, there's a danger that the political process within the regime leadership, the key driving force behind the radicalisation, is drained of significance. Ultimately, the main steps into war and genocide can't be centrally addressed through the device of the people's community. The moral questions of levels of complicity in genocidal politics are naturally important ones. But the emphasis on general complicity through membership of the people's community comes close to deflecting from the character of the political system that exploited and often initiated such complicity. The agents of the regime that produced unprecedented death and destruction in Europe were overwhelmingly German. But not all Germans were amongst those agents, and not all perpetrators of the Holocaust were members of the people's community. The undifferentiated nature of the people's community concept doesn't do justice to opponents of the regime or to those repressed or cowed into silence. And when in the later war years the regime faced mounting crisis, it saw whatever had existed of a people's community melt away, leaving only a residue of fanatics terrorising any who dared to step out of line. An indictment of how unsuccessful the Nazi regime had been in creating a solid phalanx of a people's community can perhaps be gleaned from the words of none other than the Reich propaganda minister Josef Goebbels speaking in September 1942, before the plunge in Germany's fortunes. Goebbels claimed in a speech at that time that the English motto, "My country, right or wrong," was not practical for Germany, and that 9 years after the Nazi revolution, these are Goebbels' words, the skin of the German people was so thin that it needed only to be scratched for the old wounds to be reopened. Now, concepts used in historical explanation are invariably difficult, subject to more than one interpretation, and often prompting debate that casts more heat than light. Totalitarianism is one such term that comes to mind, a concept of loaded value rather than clean analytical content. It doesn't mean that it's devoid of value, but that value is limited. And the same could be said of the concept of the Volksgemeinschaft. The emphasis upon the concept in recent research on the Society of the Third Reich has certainly led to some important and interesting insights. The concept might have helped to spur some significant research, without, however, being ultimately central to it. Care needs to be taken that the term doesn't simply become a given and critically accepted, which then becomes in itself an explanation. The constraints on its usage are real and weighty. Overall, and this is perhaps at the risk of offending some friends in this audience, it seems to me a concept of limited value, which can indeed be usefully deployed in certain restricted ways, but also has major and insuperable defects as a tool, genuine tool of analysis. Thank you very much for your attention.